So where are, who are the lost tribes of Israel?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey friends, welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. This is Michael Brown, and we're going to play for you today one of the most fascinating interviews we've ever done here on the Line of Fire. Let us go to Jerusalem. I'll set things up here. All right, I'm sitting here. We're in Jerusalem, and just so happened that some of our folks ran into a most fascinating gentleman doing some extremely fascinating work, and you're going to find out some things you never knew before. All right, give us your name, please.
Harry Rosenberg.
And Harry, you have an online theological institute. That's great, but there's something else you do which is absolutely fascinating.
Correct. It's called the Theological Research Institute. But on my free time, I've been actually studying the diaspora of the 10 northern tribes of Israel, where they went and who they may be today.
All right, so there's one traditional myth that the 10 lost tribes are just over some mythical river somewhere and will one day be rediscovered. So that we can dismiss. And then there's the more common view, they're just scattered and gone to history. In your view, having looked at this over a decade now, what's the reality?
Right. Well, first of all, there's two things here. We have the actual literal descendants of these humans who went to exile, and we do have this mythical place that we call the Sambation River, which what we've actually been taught is not the 10 tribes are on the other side of it, but there's the descendants of Moses somewhere hidden today in the world who are studying the Torah as exactly as Moses had taught it without any confusion, and they're hiding and waiting till the final time to return. So that we could leave for later on, but we'll discuss today the actual descendants of these 10 tribes. And we know around 722 before the Common Era, the Assyrian kingdom exiled towards the Far East the 10 northern tribes of Israel.
Now, we know that some fled to the south. We know there are references in the days of Hezekiah. We know even in the days of Josiah, Jeremiah, the third chapter, there's a call to repent in the north. So we know that there were some Israelites that stayed in the north, but we also know many were exiled. What about the Samaritans? Who are they?
Right. It's interesting. If you actually look at the scriptures, we see during these waves of exiles, even the Judean exile, not all of the tribes were taken out of the land. Some of them were left in the land. It was usually the higher, the aristocrats were taken out of the wealthier people, but the poor people were left in the land. So there was also swapping where they would bring, the Assyrians would bring people from outside of Israel into Israel. So the Samaritans would appear to anyone as the people of Israel because they're practicing Israelite customs and traditions. They have their own version of a Torah. So there must be descendants of someone who had been left in the land. But as we see, the truth is very, very difficult to pass down from generation to generation as an unbroken telephone type of game. There was a story in the Second Temple where they found a Torah in the temple that they didn't have one for many years. So we can't expect that all these tribes around the world would have been preserving the same exact version of Torah compliance. But if anyone looks at the Samaritans, they would clearly look like descendants of some type of Israelites who stayed in the land, whether people who were brought in and converted or pureblood Israelites.
And we know there's the core of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob physically, but then throughout Israelite history, there were people marrying in and becoming part of the larger people of Israel, be it someone like a Ruth or be it the mixed multitude that came out of Egypt and became part of the people of Israel. So from your viewpoint, what would make someone a legitimate Israelite or Jew?
Right, these are two different terminologies that are used today. So let's say we'll discuss places around the world where we'll have 25 to 50 million people who claim to be from the tribes of Israel. Someone asks me, well, are they Jewish? And I say no, because the term Jew actually comes from Judean, the Judean kingdom, the descendants of the Judean kingdom, who, from Ezra and Nehemiah, coded the law. They wrote down, 2,000 years ago, they wrote down the law, the Mishnah. So anyone who's one with 613 commandments, that is how you become a Jew. To be one with 613 commandments and the oral interpretations has been passed down. Now, someone who is from the house of Israel who got lost amongst the nations, the term would be Zera Yisrael, or the seed of Israel, someone from the seed of Israel. And every single day, and all over the scriptures, you'll see these two entities, the people of Judah and the Israelites. And Jews, every single day when we pray, we actually reference the unification. Before we do the silent prayer, the Amidah, we reference Yehuda v'Yisrael, Judah and Israel reuniting. So these people who we find around the world, they're not necessarily Jews, but the way we look at it, this is not necessarily about religion. If you find your long-lost cousin after thousands of years wandering, you know, or even nowadays, your cousin gets lost and you find him after 10 years, he was in the desert, your first question is not going to be, how many times a day are you praying? You're not going to ask him that. You're going to say, how do you have food? Do you have water? So right now we're making this about a family operation, not a religious one.
All right, so just one more question on the religious end, which is a curious one. There are groups, say Ethiopian Jews, and we'll go around the world and find out where you believe they're legitimate descendants of the tribes of Israel. But they were not familiar with certain rabbinic customs. So one view would be that's because the rabbinic customs were later. The rabbinic view would be, you know, a lot of our traditions go all the way back to Moses at Mount Sinai, have been passed on, so these Ethiopian Jews need to become more genuine. Another argument would be, no, the traditions come later, the Ethiopian Jews go back further. Well, what's your take on how these things developed?
I mean, just growing up in America in a non-religious home and then becoming religious later on and then becoming a teacher in the conservative movement in their schools, I saw that in about 1.5 generations, you could forget who you are and lose absolutely everything. So the fact that a tribe who's, you know, all the way on the other side of the world, somewhere in Africa, removed from Israel, who was left at a time prior to the customs of the Israelites being written down, actually, because they're not practicing something, has zero bearing on me of what the people of Israel were actually doing. Because when the scripture says to build a sukkah or to make a mezuzah or all these commandments, you have to assume Moses had a specific way he himself was doing it, and you have to assume he told his children or they told their children, and so on and so forth. And now today I see that they're, you know, so I'm a rabbi, I took rabbinical ordination, so I could trace my rabbi, all the way back to Moses and assume that the way we're building or making our tzitzit, weaving our tassels or building our sukkah was actual an inheritance from Moses. So when you see like the Ethiopians out there, is nothing wrong with them. They went into the exile. They played their role. They were destined to go in the exile. But what I do believe personally is that the core of rabbinic Judaism, you know, at what point can you make up such a complex religion? This must have been taught from Ezra and Nehemiah, who were from the high courts of Israel, who had inherited from the last generations of the prophets.
Got it. All right. Yeah, so that's definitely another discussion for another day, but I appreciate your perspective on it. Okay, so let's go around the world now. We know that the 10 tribes scattered, so in a certain direction, and then where did they get lost in history? Where can we recover them in history? So let's trace it out, and you give me some of the largest people groups that have some clear markers that tie them back into the children of Israel.
Okay, this is going to get very interesting. At any point, if I'm talking too long, you just give me a little sign, and you can ask a question, interrupt me. So you have, let's say, the base of where the Assyrians would have sent the Israelites. Had they have gone towards the Far East, you have Afghanistan, and you have the Pashtun people there who self-identify as being from the children of Israel. Another word for Pashtun, they refer to themselves as Bani Israel, the children of Israel. Now, there's 25 million in Afghanistan. There's 15 million Pashtun in Pakistan and 5 in India. If you look at their customs and traditions, they're doing 8-day circumcisions. They are, you know, they're doing levirate marriage. So if someone passes away without a child, the wife will marry the brother to keep the name alive. This is something only found in the Mosaic Law. They actually wear four-cornered garments like the people of Israel would. They do have a day they refer to as Shabbat. They call it Sabbata. And they actually refer to every day of the week as we do as the first day from Saturday, the second day from Saturday. So they count around Saturday as their day. And they've been converted to Islam over time. But if you look at their own code, which is called Pashtunwali, when it comes in conflict with the Quran, they actually go by the law of Moses. And specific examples would be if the Muslims around them are eating camel or celebrating eating camel, they would say our code wouldn't allow eating camel because from the laws of Moses, from the prophet of Jacob.
All right. Now, before we look at other people groups, do they have any sense of solidarity with the modern nation of Israel and with the Jewish people as a whole?
So you're actually speaking about one of the biggest topics of going to be the future of political Israel is emerging as we speak. Like literally this week, there's developments in this relationship. But this started, let's say, for me. There's been relationship with the Pashtun since Israel became a state. They've sent people there to document it. They've written books about it. One of the first presidents, Ben Tzvi, has written extensively on this. So we knew about this, and we've been trying to reach them, organizations, for, you know, 70 years already almost. When I was in yeshiva, a yeshiva student, reading about the 10 tribes, reading about the names of the clans in Afghanistan, the Rubaini, the Gadi, the Ashuri, these are the major clans, the Yosefzai, the children of Yosef. If you saw Malala Yosefzai, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize recently, her last name means children of Yosef, children of Joseph, and she's a Pashtun. The first thing I did was I had reactivated my Facebook account, because when you're in yeshiva, you deactivate your Facebook account because it's very distracting when you're trying to live a life of Torah study. I opened up my Facebook account, and I started searching in the names of clans in Afghanistan, and I started messaging messaging people from there, asking them, is it true you're from the 10 tribes of Israel? 100% of them had agreed, and they said they are from the tribes of Israel, 100%, literally. And I was asking people all over. And so for the past 10 years, not just myself, but there's been activists in this field who've been making diplomatic relationships with Afghanistan and pushing and teaching and educating. It's come to the point where the president's office, the president of Afghanistan, has sent his top advisors to work with the Jewish leaders to come to an understanding of how they could come together. So if anyone wants to speculate on the future of news, you'll see the newest diplomatic relationship will be the Israel-Afghan relationship.
All right. I mean, and this is so mind-blowing to most because you think of Afghanistan and Taliban and radical fundamentalism and all of this, and yet you're saying there's an Israelite base in the midst of it.
Well, sure. If you look at Iran today, they're actually pouring lots of capital, and even Saudi Arabia, even though they don't get along, they both pour a lot of capital into Afghanistan to radicalize the Pashtun there. So when we speak to the tribal elders in Afghanistan, which is very common, they say to us, we are worried we won't have a future of our people because of radical Islam, which is taking our young kids from home and radicalizing them on these anti-Israel and anti-American ideas. So it's a very sensitive thing. So now we're in touch with the president's office in Afghanistan, and they're saying how Russia specifically, Iran is specifically, I'm thinking Russia because meddling in presidential elections, because Iran is actually helping finance and boost political opponents to the Pashtun, because there's a few minority clans out there, to have Iranian-backed influence. So this is the seat of Afghanistan is in question right now, and the future of these people who are claiming to be from the tribes of Israel. So now more than ever, the Jewish people actually have to take this as a cause upon themselves to do something about it. And tonight, while discussing, we could talk about what some of those solutions would look like.
All right. And then if we go right in the heart of the Middle East, the Palestinians, you think, okay, Palestinians, anti-Israel, hating the Jewish people, you know, Hamas and radical Palestinian Authority leader, whatever it is, that's the general perception. And yet there's DNA evidence and more that a certain percentage of Palestinians are actually Israelites.
This is going to get crazy also. Ben Tzvi, the first president of Israel, one of the first presidents, also wrote extensively about the Palestinians. And we've identified, and I'm going conservative right now because there's people who have much higher numbers, but I'm not going to throw any radical numbers. They'll say about 25% of the Arab, there's no such thing as a Palestinian, let's say. Let's call them, because they're all from different areas, Arabic-speaking people, tribes in Israel. This is how you defer to them. Let's say there's 25% of them self-identify as being from the Jews who went through forced conversions to Islam. Some of them we could trace from, let's say, 2,000-something years ago when we see the scripture saying they left the wine bearers and the land to take care of the hills and the mountains. Some of them come from communities as far as 100 years ago who were forced converted. Some of them have under their floorboards remnants from Spain from the 1400s who we know some of them came to Israel who went through forced conversions.
All right, friends, I'm going to jump in here for a moment. We'll take a quick break, and then we will resume this fascinating interview about the Lost Tribes of Israel with Rabbi Harry Rosenberg. Don't go anywhere.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown. I hope you're enjoying this interview with Rabbi Harry Rosenberg. He's an Orthodox Jewish rabbi, so we don't agree about a lot of things in the faith. And a lot of what he's saying, people, other scholars will differ with. Many will say this is absolutely accurate as we talk about who are, where are the lost tribes of the House of Israel. Let's go back to our interview.
Now, we're not speaking about individuals here. We're speaking about communities and actual villages of Palestinians who have this identity. And I want to tell you a crazy statistic. Before I do that, I'm going to tell you a story. I had ordered a couch to my house from IKEA in Israel, and I had the Arab workers come and deliver. And now every day, Arabs and Jews interact peacefully in Israel. There's really no issues. A lot of it's hyped up. And certain areas, it's hot, and we'll get to it. And they're in my house building the couch, and I say to them, I said, hey, I heard that there's a percentage of the Palestinians who come from, or the Arabic-speaking clans, who come from the people of Israel. Is it true? He says to me, yes, I'm one of them. He was actually a Christian Arab, but he said, I'm one of them. I am really Jewish. And I said, okay. And my little son was in the room, and he always hears me speaking about it. And he all of a sudden he saw that actually someone agreed to it, you know, and he was like, that was shocking. So they finished working, and I said, hey, would you guys like a round of shots? You know, you work so hard, I'll give you each a shot of scotch, or I have, you know, a good bottle. And they all said, yeah, sure, we'd love a shot. So I pour a round of shots, me and the Palestinian Arab-speaking workers, and we're about to take a shot. And this Arabic-speaking man makes a blessing, a Jewish blessing in Hebrew, Shehako Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Shehakol Nehiyeh Bidvaro, and he takes the shot. And it, you know, so obviously he was raised in a family that they're hiding, and they know they have Jewish roots. This is very prevalent. But the crazy thing is, you'll see a lot of the terrorism in Israel comes specifically from the villages that we know were once Jewish. A good example of this would be there was a shooting in Sarona Mall in Tel Aviv, I think it was a year or two ago. A lot of people were shot down. And they said in the news, and the gunman was from Yatta, a village in the West Bank. Anyone could have gone to Yatta on Wikipedia and seen that it was once an exclusive Jewish community who is now exclusive. And it's all the same family. They marry within their clans. And so the reason, and you think about it, what could be leading these Palestinians to, who were once Jews, to be the ones who are killing you know, the other Jews? So they say today they're not really accepted as Arabs, pure blood Muslim Arabs. They're actually, I think the term would be musta'arabim, like hidden Arabs. They're not like a converso would be called, or a derogatory term would be a Murano. So that is a derogatory term for these Arabs. And I believe what I've read from the writings was in 1948, when Israel became a state, they had somewhat petitioned to be involved in the state, to play a role as also descendants of Judah. And the Israelis were absolutely having none of that. That was not a discussion for them at the time. So you have people with zero identity who had lived really bad lives and low quality of life, and they're snapping. They're going, mm-hmm. So this is something that is going to have to be looked into.
You know, it reminds me of Turkey trying to join the European Union and being excluded, and then it starts to go the way of radical Islam. It reacts in the other direction. It's almost a kind of a parallel thing. You get excluded by one group, and now you turn and get radicalized. All right, let's move out, and let's move into Africa. What do you have there?
Well, for sure, because the two main places you'll see today, we're going to get back to Afghanistan for a little bit, but the two main places, and which I mean Afghanistan, the Silk Road, but in Africa, the two largest tribes in the world today are one in Afghanistan, the Pashtun, and one in Africa. You do have the Ethiopians, you do have the Lemba tribe in South Africa, who we know we had the Cohen gene, the priestly genetics, the Y chromosome, amongst almost 10% of them. We have different tribes all over, but the largest is the Igbo tribe of Nigeria, numbering 40 million people who self-identify as being from the children of Israel. They're doing eighth-day circumcision out there. They have a lot of customs, you know, from Jewish weddings to Jewish mourning that you'll only find amongst Mosaic law. And they are going through their own political struggles right now. There was a genocide on them in the 1960s. Millions of them were killed. Israel actually broke the blockade. But why the Igbo are most fascinating is because they're actually returning now to Judaism. There's, I think, 48 synagogues now in Nigeria who are from the Igbo, and that number is growing rapidly. The leader of the Free Igbo Movement, if you will Google, his name is NNAMDI Madi. He wears a tallit, a prayer shawl, to his court appearances. When he goes in for treason trials, he's wearing his tallit. But the Igbo made up a significant percentage of the transatlantic slave trade. So a lot of the blacks that were taken to America on the slave ships actually had Igbo blood in them. And we see now Igbo are self-identifying as from the tribes of Israel. So if you look in America today, you'll see a lot of celebrities actually from the African-American community claiming Hebrew roots. Reference would be Amari Stoudemire, high-profile basketball player, rapper Kendrick Lamar, who's I don't know, maybe a billion views on some of his stuff. These are people who are influential, and people look at them like maybe they're crazy. How do they have any ties to the tribes of Israel? Then all of a sudden, we see the actual ships that brought him here are coming from the exact place in Africa where it's an Israelite hotbed. So this is going to be also an interesting piece of the puzzle.
I recently became friendly with a black Messianic Jew, and he was educating me on the black Hebrew-Israelite movement. So I just knew that as some kind of cult that says the white man is the manifestation of Satan and that they're the original Israelites and Jews like you and me, we are fake Jews, etc. And this felt – but I didn't have a lot of information or history because I'm so much outside of that community. So this fellow's historian, he's well-educated in these areas, and he's going through the whole history of where they came from in Africa and identifying as black Jews or black Israelites. And then he said that these then began to expand it to say all blacks are the real Israelites and the whites are not. So, but it started with folks that generally had this heritage. And he'll tell me, oh, yeah, this is how we pronounce this in our community. We have this tradition. So you're saying then, as far as you can tell, you can trace footsteps that can say, here's how we got from here to hear? Or is it simply a matter of, well, why else would people identify like this? How do you figure it out?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, the Igbo tribe in Africa claims to be the descendants of the Judeans who fled into Egypt at the time of Gedaliah. This was also around the time of the destruction of the temple. There was a verse, my memory's not the best, but there's a verse that says they fled into Egypt and they stay there and they didn't come back to Israel. So they claim to be the travelers of those communities. Now, one of the mysteries of the tribes we're going to get into when we speak about the Silk Road right now is, are these the descendants of 100,000 Israelites, or are they the descendant of one Israelite? And the answer is almost irrelevant because there's no way to really understand or fully know that at this point in time. Let's go back to the Silk Road for a second to discuss this identity thing. And we'll go back to the African Americans because their hate for the white people, which I had a debate with someone who hated white people. He told me my grandparents enslaved his grandparents and I owe him money. I told him my grandparents were farmers in Europe, so we had to get on the same page. But there's a lot of trauma from the transatlantic slave trade and from what happened. It's all very fresh. So we have to be very diplomatic and sensitive about them. I understand why they would hate a white man. That makes total sense to me as far as understanding neurology in the brain. Let's say you're back at the Silk Road right now. Within 100 or 200 years of the tribes of Israel going towards the Far East, you have three main things get established within the same period of time. One is the Pashtun people. Next, you have Buddhism was founded. We know the first two students of the Buddha were from the first two lay students of the Buddha were from Afghanistan, from a region where the Pashtuns are today, all within the same years. And then you have what becomes most interesting is the Shinto empire forms. Shintoism today has a king. It's the oldest monarchy on planet Earth. It's a 2,600-year-old line of kings. And they claim, I'm speaking on behalf of the Shinto religion now, 70 million people. The Shinto religion claims that they were once a chosen nation, exiled from their homeland, who've reestablished their kingdom on the island of Japan. Now, if you go to Japan today, you, as a tourist, you can go to Mount Moriah in Japan, where they have their holy temple. Now, we know Mount Moriah in Israel is where King Solomon's temple was built. So you can go to Japan and visit Mount Moriah, where they have their holy temple. In their holy temple, they have three chambers, an outer chamber where people celebrate, an inner chamber where they're doing animal sacrifices on deers, and they have an inner chamber where they, in Japan, their religion stores a golden ark on four poles with big golden birds on it, and they keep three things in their ark, just like the Israelites would have kept three things in their ark. And now it comes interesting to you because you speak about rabbinic Judaism and 10 tribe pre-rabbinic Judaism. All the priests in Japan, you Google it for yourself, it's called Yamabushi, Yamabushi. They all wear what would appear to be phylacteries on their forehead with four-cornered garments, and they blow a shofar horn. So, you know, you juxtapose a picture of a rabbi with his phylacteries, his tefillin, next to a Japanese priest with his, and you're kind of looking the same thing. If you look at the Japanese alphabet also, which people say it's a little more modern and recent, it's nothing like Chinese or Mandarin, but it actually has Hebrew letters all throughout it. Even the company Uniqlo, a famous Japanese brand, you'll see, I think, you know, 60-something percent of their logo is clear Hebrew letters. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, we know in the Mishnah, so written somewhere in a little after 200 of the Common Era, so traditions going back further than that, it's talking about the Jewish people in terms of their color. How are we described?
Right. So Rabbi Yehuda Nasi wrote the Mishnah. He was a direct descendant from the house of King David, and he was in charge of the passing on the law of the generation. Now, to have written down the oral law was forbidden for the Israelites. It was oral, meant to be taught father to son. He saw that we are already scattered around the whole world, and if we don't preserve this, we're going to lose it. So he chose to write it down, and it was called the Mishnah. In the Mishnah, he was speaking about the skin afflictions that happened to people in the times of the temple, and when he's speaking about the color of the skin, he references and says that the children of Israel were not white, and they were not black. They were boxwood. That's the word it was used, perhaps like the color of the table we're sitting at. And, you know, you have to imagine he was saying the children of Israel, I think he was speaking about in past tense of who they were. At the time already that he was alive, you had great, Roman converts who became Torah scholars. Rabbi Akiva's father was a convert. Rabbi Akiva was one of the greatest sages ever. You had Unculus, you had Shemaya and Avtalion. These were masters on the Torah chain who were converts from Rome. So obviously there was a genetic mixing that had happened already at that time. You look at King Solomon, who married 1,000 wives. What would that genetic mixing look like for their descendants who wanted to graft in and become part of the whole picture? You know, you had King David, who comes from Moabite blood, who, for all you know, there was Sodomite blood in that relationship somehow from Lot's wife. I don't know her genealogy too well. So the people of Israel were a total mix of all the nations, of all the people. And what defines us is not genetics or DNA. It is truth. We are a nation bound by a truth.
All right. got to jump back in, and we're going to continue this interview on the other side of the break. Look, some say the lost tribes of Israel are lost. You have a tiny little remnant that came down and merged with Judah. And so the Jewish people today have all the different tribes among them, or it's larger than a remnant, but all the lost tribes among them. Others say they've just been lost to history. Others say, no, they can be found and identified. And there are interesting prophetic passages about the reunification of Judah with Israel at the end of the age. So we shall see what unfolds. But this is really fascinating stuff. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, friends, welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast here on the Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, and today we are playing for you an interview that I did with Orthodox Jewish Rabbi Harry Rosenberg in Jerusalem in May. He has been searching for the lost tribes of the House of Israel for many years and believes they can be found in different communities all around the world. We're going to jump back into the interview now. You can watch all of it on our YouTube channel whenever you have the opportunity.
All right, so you've got then a people scattered around the world. There's a lot of different ethnicity, but ultimately to be preserved, there has to be some marrying in. If everyone just married out, assimilated, gave up their traditions, they'd basically be lost to history. And yet these different groups have preserved either an identity that says we're descendants of the children of Israel, or certain customs, maybe even tribes that practice customs they don't know why, and then kind of the light goes on. So I've heard about this a lot, oddly enough, from Gentile Christians, Hispanics, attending Messianic Jewish congregations, and they love the Jewish traditions, and it seems very real to them. It doesn't seem like someone putting on something foreign, but rather putting on something native to them. And then many claim that they're the children of Anusims, forced converts and things like that, or that their families always preserved certain customs, traditions, didn't know why. So let's look at that, the larger Hispanic world, and then Spain, Portugal, Latin America. What are you looking at there in terms of numbers of potential children of Israel?
Right. Firstly, the government of Israel had been working about a year on studying this to release an official report, which just about a month and a half, 2 months ago, was released. So if the Hebrew copy is on the internet. I have a copy of an English one where you could actually read their whole understanding on the subject, where they speak about, you know, the forced conversions and who went who and where'd they go and what the government wants to do about it. So now you see it from a governmental level, from the Ministry of Diaspora. So it must be something very real for them to have put resources and scholars onto this. I'm actually friends with a lot of Anusim in South America. Some of them actually, you know, tell me they have dreams of being strung up on a board and their limbs stretched and men with hoods and holding fire torches. Yeah, they people have these dreams, and I did a lot of studying also in Israel. I think recently proved there is some type of inheritance of trauma we can get through genetics from ancestors, and we can get to another time. But when we're looking at this community, we're seeing people with specific last names who are doing specific customs, like hiding candles, very common, hiding candles Friday afternoon. When a Jew enters Shabbat, they light the Shabbat candles. These individuals are putting candles under a basket in the corner of the house and lighting them, and they don't have a clue why. And they're not eating pig at the local community barbecues. And all of a sudden, now you have the internet, they're starting to say, hey, wait a minute, the Jewish people light candles at the same time we do, and they don't eat pig. And wait, there was an Inquisition where we know we came from Spain around the same time where the people flee. And all of a sudden, it makes sense to them. And then we say, okay, who are these people? And we see they're not individuals. They're the descendants of family clans from specific towns and villages in Spain. They keep the same last name. So you'll have a lot of the Mendozas, the Gonzaleses, the Cardozas. These are names that, like from the New York Yankees, Sabathia means a Sabbath keeper. These are names that we'll say are typically the descendants of the Anusim. So someone says, I'm a descendant of the Anusim, Israel actually will look into it. What's your last name? Where's your village from? Do you have marriage documents from your grandparents? Oh, we see they're from the village of Jews, and you're now part of maybe a 14 to 20-something million person population, conservatively, and this could be because of people who've intermarried or just gotten lost. Could be 70 or so million people.
All right, the father Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, famous historian, has this massive 1,500-page work on the Inquisition. And did he argue that the Inquisition really starts as the church trying to purge out Jewishness, that some of these forced converts maintain Jewishness, and the Inquisition was trying to purge that out? So a lot of times people look at it as just an inner Christian issue, or one group of Christians persecuting another group of Christians. But is there a deeper Jewish connection behind the Inquisition?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, there's a, you know, I didn't read that work you're referencing, but I would say there's a Kabbalistic viewpoint that we have on this as well. There's the purpose of the there's a purpose to the exile and a purpose why Israelites had to travel around the world. There was a mission that we're fulfilling. So there's a certain point where there has to be a movement where we'd have to a catalyst to say you've done what you've had the golden era of Spain has happened. You've extracted whatever has happened. Now you go on the next leg of the journey. It's almost like a sick joke. You know, is God playing a sick joke on us? You have the Spanish Inquisition, you have the Holocaust, and from these things, you know, growth comes out. You have the State of Israel was born after the Holocaust. So what's really going on at the time of all this destruction and death, that there's a next evolution? So I would speak about, I can go in deeper if you want, about the Kabbalistic take on what the Inquisition about or what was happening.
Yeah, so that's a conversation for another day, the mystical explanations. And of course, from the New Testament perspective, there's no resurrection without crucifixion. So it's often, there's a verse where Yeshua says, unless a grain of the wheat falls in the ground and dies, it remains alone. So it is part of our history. Out of the ashes of the Holocaust and the horrors of that, the modern state of Israel's birth, it's all beyond belief. No one could script this. What you're saying is also beyond belief, no one could script, and yet the more you look at this, the more evidence there is. And yeah, go ahead.
I just want to throw in one thing. I would also argue, it could be for another time, that a lot of these messianic principles, like you just said, would actually be rooted in the Kabbalah itself.
All right. So that's a discussion for another day.
Yeah.
Okay. That would be to me like
to say Kabbalah is messianic, not say Kabbalah is messianic, but some principles like even the concept of a suffering Messiah. You'll see it says in Tanakh, Mechulal Mipasheinu, he's blunted because of our sins. He's suffering because of our sins. That's from the Tanakh. So if I tell a Jew this concept of this suffering because of our sins concept, they'll say that's Christian. That's messianic. I'll say no. It's in your own scriptures, your own Tanakh. We just have to understand what our sages said about it. So we could have a future conversation about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. To me. The only reason that the New Testament is saying certain things is because they're thoroughly grounded in the Tanakh. If it came as a new religion, then we shouldn't have followed it.
Well, we'll talk about the Council of Nicaea and other things at a future date. But I'll tell you one thing. My work with the Lost Tribes of Israel has almost nothing to do with religion or conversion.
Yeah.
Those two words never come into my plan right now for next steps for this, which is interesting.
Yeah, very, very interesting, for sure. And I'm listening and just filtering everything. We each have our lens through which we hear and filter. All right, before I ask a big scriptural question in the book of Ezekiel and the two sticks coming together and all of that, the question of descendants of Israel or those who identify as Jews in India, China, you mentioned Shinto religion in Japan, what do you feel confident in terms of saying, okay, these are people that legitimately self-identify or have roots that are legitimately Israelite or Jewish in China and India?
Right. So you have now the B'nai Menashe. Well, you have two communities in India. You have the West Coast and the East Coast. On the West Coast of India, you'll have descendants of the Spanish Inquisition who are Jewish communities, not saying they're from the tribes of Israel. You had famous wealthy Jewish families like the Sassoon family where it became very wealthy Indian Jews, and they claim to have been from the 1400s who fled Spain. Now, they're all over the West Coast of India. There's communities. They call themselves B'nai Ephraim or the B'nai Israel there. Now, on the East Coast, south of China, on the Mizoram-Manipur border near Bangladesh, you have what's called the B'nai Menashe, the children of Menashe, who claim to be from the original exile, from Afghanistan, who had traveled. We can actually trace the roots of the 10 tribes over and under the Himalayan mountains. So this would have been the community that went under the Himalayan mountains and have settled there. They come from the Kuki and Shinlung clans. Let's say there's about, you know, 10 or so, maybe 1,000 of them who are Jewish and converting and becoming, saying they're from the tribes of Israel. Let's say there's a few hundred thousand of them from that same family clan who's messianic, a Christian, who's not self-identifying. And let's say there could be a few million within that genetic pool of that specific type of people. And they're out there right now, and they put the flag of Israel on the ground, and they say, we're their own Israel army. They're an outpost of Israel, which you'll start to see happen in villages all around the world. Now, if you go to the north over the Himalayas, there's a path. You'll actually see in Kyrgyzstan, the Kyrgyz people claim to be from Menasha also. And we know Menasha lived as a half, they had a half a tribe in one region and the other tribe somewhere else. Now in Kyrgyzstan, they have their own religion called the Epic of Manas, which is all about Manas, the son of Jacob. That's their religion. The religion of the Kyrgyz people is all about Menasha. They're living in yurts and they're nomadic people. So literally, when you go from Afghanistan, you could actually see the descendants of the Israelites in Kashmir, Kashmiris, who claim to be from these people, where they say even, not that I believe in the Jesus narrative, but they say Jesus came there to preach to them also. Because we know in the book of Matthew, it does say Jesus went to find the 10 tribes of Israel. They went to find the lost sheep of Israel. So out there, they speak about that. And if you go over the Himalayas and under the Himalayas, you'll see all these different communities. You do have places in China where you'll have like the Kaifeng Jews, but they're not descendants of the 10 tribes. Those are Jewish people who had fled there within the last maybe few hundred years, maybe even longer, to set up a Jewish community based on Jewish law. So the whole entire region is populated with the scatterings of Israel.
So interestingly, when you take Jesus saying, for example, in Luke, that he came to seek and save the lost. And then in Matthew 10, he says, I'm sent only to the lost tribes of Israel. So you actually take lost tribes, not just meaning spiritually lost, but physically lost.
Well, two things. One is just to state my position again that I'm a Jewish rabbi, so I believe, I believe in my version, but that's irrelevant. But it says in the Talmud that the purpose of the tribes going into the exile was to come back with converts. So according to your interpretation of what Luke would be saying would be, this is for both. These are for the actual scattered Israelites. And to bring back all the other lost souls on planet Earth who were really the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Abraham himself, and Noah, and the children of Adam. This would be a holistic unification, which is what the Messianic era really is when there's a global family that gets formed around the truths of Israel.
Yeah, and no mistaking of your position on that. So I appreciate reiterating that. But okay, so we know from Scripture that there are tribes scattered. There are many people killed by the Assyrians and by the Babylonians. We know that our people are scattered in different parts of the world, and then until recently, a lot of the history is not known where people were scattered. We know that some stayed in the north and still maintain their identity, and say in the days of Hezekiah, right after the destruction of the north, came to worship in the south, or in the days of Josiah, so 150 or so years later, they're still calling on them to repent and reaching out. And so many then became part of the kingdom of Judah and would just be known as part of the larger Jewish people. So when we think of Jews today, in our mind, that's all we know of the descendants of the whole 12 tribes. They're identified as Jews today, maybe 13, 14 million people. But in your research, and this is not you independently, this is looking at the research many others have done, what is your guesstimate, conservative guesstimate, of the descendants of the children of Israel that are identifiable outside of the Jewish people today worldwide?
Right. So when the Ministry of Diaspora just released this report, they actually made tiers, like circles, of how identifiable is this community. Just between the Pashtun in Afghanistan and the Igbo of Nigeria, we're dealing with about 100 million people. Like we said, in Japan, you have the Shinto kingdom, which is 70 million people. Over there, we can't say that all 70 million people are descendants of Israelites. We can certainly say whoever founded that kingdom certainly was an Israelite.
All right, friends, just have to jump in here and take a break. We come back, we're going to resume this interview with Rabbi Harry Rosenberg. I'm not endorsing everything he says or agreeing with everything he says. I am saying that I've heard a lot of this stuff from others, and now he's bringing detailed confirmation to it. Fascinating, worth looking into. We've got one more segment. Stay right there.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, friends, this is Michael Brown. Welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let's finish off this interview with Rabbi Harry Rosenberg about the lost tribes of Israel.
We look at the Joseph and Esther theory, which is, what is the common denominator between the stories of Joseph and the story of Esther in Purim? Is they were both flung to a foreign land, and both somehow rose to power and became, almost both second in command, second in power. In the story of Purim, she was offered up to half the kingdom. Now, we have to assume that the Torah, the Tanakh, is teaching us something here. the people of Israel are going to scatter around the world, and they're going to become influential, and they're going to rise to power, and they're going to breed, and they're going to change systems, and they're going to influence the region around them. That's going to be an axiom of the exile, an axiom of truth. So when you look at Japan, I don't know if it was one curious businessman who took a ship over to the other side and made a cult and formed a new religion and became influential, and next you know, they're the Shinto people. So I can't say that the 70 million people are Jews or from the tribes of Israel. What I could say is that we could have enough people here to make a global family where we're talking about, you know, a half a billion people to a billion people who have this some – if you look at even in Papua New Guinea, we get letters from out there, the tribes out there. They wrote a letter to us once and they said, we're sitting on lots of gold on this mountain and we're waiting for the Jewish people. We want to help bring it to Israel and do business only with Israel because we're from the tribes of Israel. And I thought, you know, you get the Nigerian prince scam email. I thought, you know, this is so convenient that you have all this gold. We actually looked into – we have a vetting process that we do in our social network where we map out the tribes. We actually looked into where they came from. We saw that there is actually a lot of gold there. They're sending us pictures of them doing Israelite worship. They're actually putting time into being. So we saw that this is a phenomenon that will happen. So I'm still being conservative. If you look at Islam, Christianity, I mean, Judaism is irrelevant numbers-wise, but numbers-wise, we're talking about billions of people who are speaking about the revelation Moses had, that billions of people on planet Earth. So if there ever does arise a geopolitical situation which would resemble a global kingdom of Israel, a messianic time period, then you would have billions of people noticing that. And that's really where we're looking at right now.
And obviously, if you just look at Children of Abraham, the three monotheistic faiths identifying it in that regard. And interestingly, I've been around the world preaching the gospel and maybe 160 trips overseas. And it was really striking to me my first time in India to go in 93, my first of 25 trips there, to go into a tribal region. And these were Christians, not claiming any Israelite descent, born-again Christians that pray daily for Israel and celebrate the biblical calendar, and running into people in Africa with similar stories. So these are Christians who, rather than being anti-Semites or rather than rejecting Jewish roots, felt deeply connected. And in fact, you'll often find that in tribal areas that there's a much greater connection they can make with the Hebrew scriptures that a lot of Westerners can't make. So that's a spiritual dimension of connection. You're coming in now with lineal dimensions and other things like that. So, okay, so we get back to Ezekiel. And when the prophets will talk about their unification and the regathering, and you pray for that daily as a traditional Jew. So it seems to be, even though you're not talking about conversion religion at all right now, there seems to be something of the two sticks coming back together of great spiritual importance and also a geographic regathering where God brings us back from everywhere scattered. So we have the remnant that's been regathered from all over, representing people from all over the world. But as you read the scriptures now as a religious Jew, and now you have all this other data, what's going to happen? What your view, your script of it.
Right, for sure. This is where it gets interesting as well. There was a great verse. I also don't know the source, but it says, I will gather upon those that have already been gathered. There's going to be a regathering on top of an initial gathering. And we do speak about these two staffs, these great unifications. So we have to actually come up with a practical solution for this, because you'll speak to a lot of people and it's all wow and really cool until what are you doing about it or now what? And this is where we're going to take the scriptures and kind of this vision for what the future will look like and make it very practical with real steps that we could take. And I'll tell you what we're doing about it, because I think everyone should have their own idea of what they should be doing about it, and we should all try until we get to world peace. So this is what we're trying. We've been systematically mapping out these regions around the world on our database, a digital map on the iTribe social network. This is Afghanistan, this is Africa. And part of what I'm going to speak about now is going to use some New Age terminology. So I'll try to, for any of the viewers out there, I'll try to be very clear of what I'm speaking about. Let's say now there's a lot of communities in Africa who are claiming to be from the lost tribes of Israel. So on social media, they're posting about it. They're sharing their stuff on Facebook. And now Jews are actually donating to these communities to bring them a Torah, to build them a synagogue. They're petitioning to the Jewish people. And the Jewish people are waking up and they're saying, well, these are our lost tribes. We have to help them. So what we're doing is we're creating this whole system of who everyone is, where they are. We create a vetting process to make sure they're real. And we're actually going to work on scaling Israel. What does that mean? To bring Israel to these areas. Now, if you look at the B'nai Menashe, as we mentioned, India, they put the flag of Israel on the ground. They have their own Israel army. They have their Council of Israel. They've become Israel outside. was once in a conversation with someone. He said, oh, these last Jews in this community in China, we should bring them back. And someone else said, why would we bring them back? That's good real estate for Israel. Israel should be global. It shouldn't be only in this little area. So what we're doing is, which I have a land up north farm, we're building an off-grid sustainable battery pack, let's call it, where we're going to be producing our own electricity, pumping our own water from the ground, filtering that water, growing vertically in the air using modern technologies, and literally producing reality out of thin air using Israeli technology. We are going to be scaling this type of technology to these communities around the world to usher in what we would call the great decentralization, where nations stop becoming part of fictitious lines that were drawn with corrupt governments and start being a transparent governance system that could be run by intellectual property coming forth from Israel. Now, we're going to be doing this whole thing on the blockchain, which is a modern term for the most transparent, non-ownerless way to record data. If anyone knows what the Bitcoin is, it's a crazy thing, but it's real, it has its value, and it's on the blockchain, meaning every single transaction that ever happened with Bitcoin could always be recorded. So every community that we've put on this map right now, it's called the Future Israelite Network, has their own digital wallet where we are issuing tokens to them, digital tokens that we've created that we hope will one day have a value to them. Like when you play Monopoly, you start off the game with cash. But in the meanwhile, these digital wallets are going to be able to take donations from the Jewish people to help, like crowdfunding, says they, crowdfunding the scaling of Israel, where we can actually train and deploy soldiers from the IDF who can learn these systems and now go to these regions in Nigeria, or one day maybe be able to go to Afghanistan and actually put communities on the Israelite grid. So places that are living in poverty, or even places in America right now, is communities forming all around the Ozarks and different regions of Christians to make this decentralization based on technology. So it sounds maybe out there, but it's actually a really practical step towards taking away power from people who are promoting war and war culture, and being able to enter a place where there's power in numbers and there's going to be an Israelite voice that's going to steer the world towards world peace.
You know, it's interesting. Singapore has a special relationship with Israel. When they were founded as a nation, the IDF basically trained their military. And so there's a certain indebtedness and connection. But you're talking about something on a deeper cooperative level. But seeing it as part of the mission of Israel to bring the knowledge of the one true God to the world and thereby bring peace. So where does Messiah come in with all this?
Right. Well, because the whole thing is like what we're doing actually is what the prophecies were speaking about. So I don't have to preach the prophecies. I just have to do what they were talking about. And then people will come to see that the prophecies were true. So I want to actually fulfill the prophecies, not just talk about that they will one day be fulfilled. Now, the Messianic era is a really interesting thing. We teach that the main practical difference between pre- and post-Messianic era is that after the Messianic era, after the Messiah arrives, the yoke of the nations fall off of our shoulders. We become no more a burden of the nations, which in my modern-day millennial terms would be a decentralization, where we decentralize from these governments, which goes back to my root cause. Now, we do believe that there will be one man or two messiahs from the house of Joseph and the house of David who usher in this period and activate everyone to be messiahs. This is what we teach in Judaism. These are real humans of flesh and blood. We teach that there's a soul in the heaven called the Yechida that comes down and descends upon these. Every generation is a candidate for the Messiah, we teach, and they get activated in the future to actually play that role. Now, we say we can't legally declare a man a Messiah. I'm sure you know, because you debate rabbis, and unless he does three things, is to build a temple in Jerusalem, unite the tribes of Israel, and bring world peace. When one man does those three things, then he could legally be declared the Messiah. And we're waiting for where we think we're in that period. That's a geopolitical period right there.
Got it. And if folks want to follow what you're doing, obviously lots of Christians interested in this subject, what's the best way for them to connect with you?
Right. We just launched a free online course on this topic together with a former NBA player who's a spoken Israelite. So we have a celebrity guest on the course. You could watch videos of me and him talk about this. It's losttribes.education. Just losttribes.education, nothing else, www.losttribes.education. The course is free unless you need college credits. Someone could pay $300 for the college credits. I'm on Instagram personally as Rabbi Harry. I make posts on biblical things. And anyone can email me from the course website to find out more.
All right. Amazing, enlightening, put a lot of things together. I've heard from others, but gave further confirmation for it. And another day, we'll debate Kabbalah and Jesus.
I would love to, because I actually have a lot of unique content that I think I could offer to this to make some kind of middle ground where we can all move forward without needing to speak about this until there's world peace.
Got it. All right. Wonderful.
Friends, thanks so much for joining us. I think you've got to admit this is one of the most fascinating interviews we've ever done here on The Line of Fire. So by all means, watch the entire interview with Rabbi Rosenberg. He mentioned an online course you can take for free to find out more. Check all this out. Search this out. Come to your own conclusions. I believe there are things that he's onto that could be really accurate. There are others that are speculative. The large numbers that he's talking about, what, it's wild. But I think there's a lot more to this story than we really know. Don't get weird with things if you're a believer and you think you've got some Israelite roots. Your identity is in Jesus. That's primary. But friends, explore and see what you learn. And we'll be back with you tomorrow.